When you think of Peru, you probably think of the exotic, the ancient Inca civilization, the Amazon jungle, and the sounds of the pan flute. I'm Abby Rhodes, one of 10 University of Illinois journalism students who learned firsthand that Peru also has traffic congestion, pollution, and impoverished indigenous communities. Under the guidance of our journalism professor, Nancy Benson, we were foreign correspondents in training who spent 3 weeks in Peru reporting on topics we researched for a semester. During the next hour, we will examine and explain how colonial traditions, the result of more than 3 centuries of Spanish rule in Peru, are often in conflict with the country's first world aspirations. We collaborated with journalism students from Universidad Peruana de Ciencias Aplicadas in Lima to produce this special report entitled Assignment Peru. But first, this hour's news from National Public Radio. Peru, known to many as the land of the Incas, is representative of the Andean countries, with all the problems and promises of integrating a large indigenous population into the modern world. It's a country where more than half of the population suffers from malnutrition, and where children are often sent to work rather than to school. Peru is a microcosm of many of the problems and progress that other developing countries experience as they try to move from poverty to prosperity. I'm Abby Rhodes, one of the 10 University of Illinois journalism students who will take you into the streets of Peru during the next hour to report on the challenges this developing country faces. Because it takes money to improve a country, igniting the economy has become a priority. Peru relies heavily on the mining industry to fuel its economy, now among the fastest growing in Latin America. Adam Jadav reports from one mountain town high in the Andes, where the residents are learning about the economics of privatization and foreign investment.
This is the sound of globalization. American mining giant Doe Run operates this lead, copper, and zinc smelter here in the high Andean town of La Arroya, Peru. Doe Run is the only major employer here, with a local workforce of more than 3,000. The company's vice president, Juan Carlos Wiwa, says without the plant, the town of La Arroya would not exist.
Right now, the population is already in the order of 50,000 people already, so it's growing faster because of the local economy, no? Right here. In addition to that, is the workers are not only all of them from La Arroya, are from the Central Highlands, so also this economy spreads. So there is a lot of dependency of La Arroya.
But the 80-year-old smelter is leaving its mark on the town, in the form of pollution. Critics blame the smelter, which has had 3 different owners, for all manner of ailments in the community. A neurologist in La Arroya, Dr. Hugo Villa, says residents there suffer from asthma, chronic bronchitis, lung cancer, lead poisoning, and more.
Principally, the problems are respiratory problems, neurological problems, and developmental problems, the growth problems. According to a study done by the Ministry of Health, for the region in general and for these problems in particular, 60% of the population is afflicted.
Doe Run says it's been working to improve the air, water, and soil quality, making improvements in the community and investments in the smelter approaching $180 million. But activists point to studies that indicate dangerous levels of lead in children and other public health problems. They claim Doe Run is committing economic blackmail. The situation is common throughout the developing world, but the Deputy Economic Counsel for the U.S. State Department in Lima, David Lippiatt, says poor countries need the resources that large companies can bring.
It's a tough situation because the companies act almost in lieu of the state. The state has limited, very limited resources, and this is nothing like the U.S. or another developed country where there's a strong state presence sort of uniformly across the country. In a lot of these places, like mine, is the only thing going, literally. Nobody else has any money, including the government.
Peru's economy today is strong. The gross domestic product grew 5.1% last year, while inflation remained at 3.7%. Unemployment, a key statistic in Peruvian politics, fell by 0.9 of a point to 8.8%. Peru exported $2.5 billion more than it imported last year, with the mining industry making up more than 50% of the country's export industry. Doe Run alone had sales of more than $560 million, Peruvian economist Daniel Cordova says the country needs this.
It's better to have an investment and that create jobs and create export for the country than to have nothing. Okay, the pie is growing. Maybe the distribution of the pie is more unequal right now, but the pie is growing. I prefer the pie growing than the pie decreasing.
Cordova says the economy has been in recovery for the better part of a decade. That's after almost 20 years in the 1970s and 80s that were marked by repeated nationalization of industry, hyperinflation, and a bloody insurgency led by the socialist guerrilla group Sendero Luminoso, the Shining Path.
So the 70s and the 80s in Peru have been like a nightmare in this country. You know, economic nightmare from one side, social nightmare, as you have heard, I guess, about the Shining Path and all these problems in the 80s.
Cordova and other economists say the recovery has been pushed forward by liberal economic policies. Past President Alberto Fujimori and current leader Alejandro Toledo emphasized privatizing industry and loosening business restrictions. Doe Run bought the La Arroya smelter from the state when Fujimori privatized the plant in 1997. The smelter, with its towering smokestack and sprawling complex, sits just across a small river from La Arroya Antigua. Trucks rumble through town from the surrounding hills, bringing ores and metal concentrates from nearby mines for processing. This is the commercial center of the town. At the local market, you can buy vegetables of all types and freshly butchered meat. On street corners, men grind sugar cane to make a sweet juice. Women sell popcorn made from the giant corn grown in Peru. The town is run down. Crumbling adobe houses dot the limestone-covered mountainside. The streets are paved with roughly hewn stone. However, on corners throughout the town, there are a few clean, brightly painted buildings, stark white with green trim. They all have the same label, Doe Run Peru. The company has invested hundreds of thousands of dollars to rebuild schools, provide bathrooms, and run soup kitchens. Doe Run officials like architect Maria Elena Nunez say it's part of a commitment to corporate responsibility.
They are very poor and their families are very needy. Doe Run decided to create this program, Social Ecology, to help them with the problem. It's not Doe Run's intention to replace the government, only participate.
In a kindergarten rebuilt by Doe Run, a miniature table in the corner holds a computer, something unheard of before Doe Run stepped in. Teacher Anna Edith Basillo Landeo says the students have new books, supplies, toys, and more.
For a time, this was a night school, but the condition of the school was deplorable. It was a real disaster. In 1996 was when they started to use it as a daytime school, but even under very bad conditions. The building was in terrible condition. We had no infrastructure. It was very rustic.
A few kilometers away from the plant, children mill about a fenced yard at the Daniel Alcides Carrion Elementary School. Across from the school, on a cement field, some boys are playing soccer. Inside a classroom, there are several terrariums filled with fake bugs. A label reads Insectos. Teacher Jesus Bautista Ibana worries about funding for the school, and overcrowding, and the older kids picking on the younger students. The pollution caused by Doe Run's operations on the north side of town are not her concern. When asked about Doe Run, she has little to say.
I cannot say that the company is hurting the community. Thanks to them, we can maintain our jobs. They contribute to education, to health, to the workers and their families.
Activists in La Arroya say the teacher's position is typical. The community sees the generosity of Doe Run's programs, but the effects of pollution, asymptomatic lead poisoning, for example, are more difficult to see. A study released by the Peruvian government this year found that 99% of children in La Arroya had levels of lead in the blood above the internationally accepted standard. Neurologist Dr. Hugo Villa says the levels are high enough to cause neurological and developmental defects, particularly in young children.
Este estudio arrojó más o menos los siguientes resultados, ¿no?
Blood was drawn from kids, 788 kids less than 6 years old. 5 kids had levels of lead concentration that exceeded 70 micrograms per deciliter of blood. 84% of the children had values of the same parameter greater than 20 micrograms up to 46 micrograms per deciliter of blood. The kids that have 70 micrograms were evacuated to Lima and have been hospitalized.
Lead poisoning has been shown to slow development in children. Its effects are most devastating to young children whose brains are still growing rapidly. They are also the most at risk, as they play in lead-contaminated dirt and seldom wash their hands. When Doe Run bought the smelter, it was on the condition that it could pollute above legal levels if it also completed a series of environmental cleanup projects by the end of 2006. The company has completed 8 of 9 required projects and has spent $53 million on environmental fixes, and says it's working to control emissions. But the company still pumps out lead and sulfur dioxide well above legal limits, and it has applied for an extension until 2011 to complete the remaining projects. The government granted the extension, but an analyst with the Ministry of Energy and Mines, Alicia Polo y Laborda, acknowledges that Doe Run didn't keep its end of the bargain.
No están cumpliendo. They are not following the contract. They say that they have some problems with financial problems and they can't. And that's the problem. Like, population can't stand anymore to all this. It's not fixing pollution at all.
Activists question whether the community has seen any public health benefit at all since Doe Run took over the plant. They worry that as Doe Run has increased production of lead, that toxic emissions of lead will also increase. A group of scientists from St. Louis University in Missouri have planned a trip to La Arroya to study the situation. Dr. Fernando Serrano says he's been there already and doesn't like what he's seen.
What I saw there was just very, I think, very shocking in terms of the extent of the environmental pollution in that city, and by looking at the data on, for instance, blood lead levels in children, I was appalled to see so high the extent of lead poisoning.
But Doe Run officials say the community supports the company. They point to a pro-company strike by smelter workers last December. The protesters blocked roads and closed the plant in order to force the government to allow Doe Run to extend its environmental cleanup agreement. Activists like Yolanda Zarita, who works with the local Catholic parish, say the community is afraid of what would happen if Doe Run left, and the community turns against activists like herself.
En la población lo que hemos visto es bastante temor.
In the population, what we've seen is significant fear, the fear of openly saying, look, the smoke is affecting us, or enough already with the contamination.
And the government doesn't want to lose the income from Doe Run. David Lippiatt with the U.S. State Department in Lima says the mining industry indirectly pays for many government services through taxes.
Companies have tax agreements, and in fact, mining companies, even though they're only 6% of GDP, pay at least a fourth of all taxes. So, that's pretty good.
And Lippiatt says there's the added benefit of large companies adding money to the formal economy in a country where 60% of Peruvians work in the informal sector, off the books in menial jobs.
More formal jobs open up as larger companies that are in the formal system hire again. They expand, like, they hire people, they are able to hire more people for full wage and plus benefits, etc. But however, the informal sector still keeps growing too.
If the government began to tax too heavily, or in the case of Doe Run, impose crippling environmental regulations, mining analyst Paula Iloborda says the company could just leave.
If that happens, all the Oroy employees are going to go on strike, and they are going to lose this job. And Doe Run says, okay, if that happens, I just go. And we have a social and political issue if that happens.
No one denies that the governments of countries like Peru need large multinational companies like Doe Run. They represent investments and a source of revenue and employment, but they also sometimes operate with less scrutiny than in the United States, and in the case of La Arroya, pose a public health risk. Activists and government officials agree La Arroya cannot survive without the smelter, that much is clear, but some worry that the community is paying too high a price for economic development. Adam Jalov, reporting.
Tourism is another industry that keeps the Peruvian economy moving forward, and the hottest destination is the lost Inca city of Machu Picchu. As guidebooks point out, the Inca Empire, for all its wealth and greatness, existed for barely a century, and yet its legacy continues. The ancient archaeological site of Machu Picchu draws thousands of tourists daily, generating millions of dollars a year. But not everyone in Peru benefits equally from those tourist dollars, as Matt Stenslin reports.
It's only 7 in the morning, and the 4th train loaded with tourists already left the station to begin the 4-hour trip between Cusco and Machu Picchu. Some of the passengers are backpackers, who will get off an hour before reaching Machu Picchu, choosing the 4-day hike along the ancient Incan trail to reach their destination. The sun-worshipping Inca never finished constructing Machu Picchu. The empire was conquered by Spanish conquistadors in the 16th century. The rail passengers will arrive mid-morning at Machu Picchu Pueblo, a town commonly referred to as Aguas Calientes, at the base of the mountains. From there, they will catch a bus to the ruins. They will spend the afternoon taking in the views that no picture can capture, and listening to the different theories as to what purpose this place served. Most will catch one of the afternoon trains back to Cusco. Anna Bove of Toronto is one of more than 1.3 million tourists expected to visit Peru in 2005. 80% of them head to Machu Picchu.
Peru has a lot to offer. The cities are so different from each other, and if you go from the coast to the mountain to the jungle, you can experience in like 1 week things that people can experience in a month in other countries.
Ticket sales for entrance to Machu Picchu alone generate $10 million a year. Until 2003, all of that money was sent to the central government in Lima, and none of it was returned to the towns that feel the impact from tourism, like Machu Picchu Pueblo beneath the ruins. Although the tourism is based on the telling of Inca history, the descendants of the Incas were not benefiting from the money that history generates. That is, until Oscar Valencia got elected mayor of Machu Picchu Pueblo.
Most of the money of this Machu Picchu is going to Lima. But about that the government don't invest nothing in Machu Picchu.
Mayor Valencia organized a strike in 2003, halting the trains that bring streams of tourists. Valencia demanded 20% of all ticket revenues from entrance fees for Machu Picchu. The government agreed to give him 10%. And although he is not receiving the full amount, he does have enough to pay for 25 teachers, tourist police, and improvements to infrastructure in the surrounding Indian communities. Ciudad Grande is one of those Indian villages along the Urubamba River outside Machu Picchu Pueblo. There is no running water, plumbing, or electricity here, but there is a road now that connects the village to the outside world. It was built with tourist money, and the village recently got $20,000 from Mayor Valencia to install a system to deliver clean water from the mountains. Jaime Catacora Flores lives nearby and supervises the project.
This is a basic health problem. The water from the river is totally contaminated, so right now what we are doing is sanitizing the rural areas because there are a lot of diseases and epidemics.
Valencia continues to battle with government officials in Lima over how much money comes back to the community. He threatens to organize another strike unless he gets the full amount promised.
We think Machu Picchu is Peru. If we don't have Machu Picchu, no tourists in Peru.
Tourism is seen as one of the ways to alleviate poverty because it creates jobs. Right now, 11% of Peruvians are dependent on tourism for their livelihood. PromPeru is the government agency that promotes tourism. Its director, Carlos Zamorano, says tourism also means foreign investment and improved infrastructure, which benefits everyone.
There's a lot of poverty. We do not have enough money. And that's why we are doing a lot of effort, because we are sure that tourism is one of the biggest or most real answers for this kind of poverty.
Visiting South America has become more attractive, Zamorano says, because it is inexpensive and relatively safe.
That's why tourism is growing that fast, not only because Peru is a very beautiful destination, not only because we have money to promote Peru, but also because other parts of the world are beginning to be a little bit more problematic to visit.
A lot of their marketing has been directed at the United States, which accounts for 22% of tourists. PromPeru is now marketing to Asia, particularly China, which plans to invest considerably in Peru. At the same time, some wonder whether too much emphasis is being placed on tourism, and whether the positives actually outweigh the negatives. There is international pressure to make sure the archaeological sites and cultures are protected. Tourist Mike Green was in Peru for his honeymoon to see the archaeological sites and to experience the culture with his new wife.
The ruins, the archaeological areas, of course, are authentic, you know, but the crowds kind of detract from being able to really experience them. Cusco, some of the things they do locally, the dances and the little shows they put on and stuff. I mean, I know they're poor people, I know they're trying to make money, but yeah, I would like to have visited here 20, 25 years ago.
There's also international pressure coming from the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, which is on the verge of placing Machu Picchu on its list of endangered sites. The organization is working with Peru officials on a plan to ensure the integrity of the sites and surrounding communities. UNESCO wants Peru to cut in half the number of tourists that visit Machu Picchu. The problem isn't necessarily the damage tourists may cause to the site, it's their sheer number and how they affect the surrounding communities. Armando Cruz Torres, a Machu Picchu guide, thinks the site could handle even more people if the flow of tourists from Cusco was controlled.
For example, now it's impossible to control that. Why? Because the first train left at 6 a.m. The second train, 6:15. The another train, 6:30. The another, 6:45. And the local train left at 7:45. Looks only they give 15 minutes. The space is for that. Sometimes it's very crowded.
Overcrowding isn't the only concern. University of Illinois professor and anthropologist Helene Silverman spent 6 months in Cusco studying the effects of tourism on the ancient Incan capital. She's concerned with the Disneyland feel the city has developed and how it conflicts with the lives of the people. Silverman found that the people who live in Cusco don't mind the city revolving around tourism, even if it means they can't eat at the restaurants in the main square of the city because they are too expensive.
I think they're losing a quote-unquote authentic sense of self. They don't see themselves as losing. They've just shifted their social venues.
She's also concerned that a heavy reliance on tourism could be dangerous, given Peru's history. She says during the 1980s and 90s, the Shining Path, or Sendero Luminoso, terrorized the country in hopes of toppling the government and replacing it with communism.
That's a real problem in Cusco, is the day there's another 9/11 attack and people stop flying and therefore don't go to Peru, Cusco dies, and that's what happened to Cusco for almost 10 years with Sendero Luminoso, when there was a period of time when there was practically no tourism in Cusco, and they have nothing else.
David Lippiot from the U.S. Embassy in Peru analyzes tourism and agrees it can be a volatile industry that can evaporate after events ranging from economic downturns and terrorism to internal labor strikes, like those in the city of Arequipa.
That area lost a lot of money because of canceled tours due to that unrest. And in fact, as a longer term, they have lost tour bookings for months in advance because of that, even though it's all over.
Ludita Lecalos Uslo doesn't seem worried. She has worked in the Pisac market for 25 years selling her quilts and weavings to the tourists. The tourists are dropped off at the market on their way to the Sacred Valley, another Incan archaeological site 10 miles outside Cusco.
Since we saw that tourists would visit, we're working with ceramics, textiles, jewelry, and everything that tourists want.
Work in the fields is less profitable, she says, but it'd always be an option. For now, she prefers to practice her trade.
I make enough to fulfill my needs and to educate my children.
Uslo says she makes enough money, but for many in Peru, having enough money just means being able to survive. There are signs that the money from tourism is being used to make a difference in the lives of some Peruvians, but it is unclear whether the jobs created by tourism are enough to bring people out of poverty. Reporting, I'm Matt Stenzlin.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a radio special produced by 10 journalism students at the University of Illinois. I'm Abby Rhodes, one of the students who spent 3 weeks in Peru as part of Professor Nancy Benson's international reporting class. As the descendants of the Incas fight for their share of tourism dollars, they struggle to be heard in a country where indigenous people are often shunned. Racism has plagued Peru since Spanish conquistadors invaded the country in the 1500s and treated the Indians as expendable laborers. As Cynthia Edwards reports, the colonial class system in Peru is still strong.
Peruvians are proud of their Incan past,
Huge billboards advertise Peru's most popular soft drink, Inca Cola. Inca pharmacies are widespread throughout Peru's capital, and the Incan village of Machu Picchu brings in the majority of Peru's tourism dollars. But sociologist Pilar Arroyo says just because a country celebrates its heritage of the Incas, the Quechuan-speaking people of Peru's highlands, it does not mean it also values the Incas' descendants.
The social relations in our society are marked by a long history of discrimination and oppression. This discrimination and oppression is based on class, on race, on ethnicity, on gender. Many people think that if the Spaniards, when they came to Peru, would have done what the Anglo-American did in the United States, they annihilate the original population, no? The Indians, we would be better.
Arroyo says the Peruvians subject to the most discrimination are those who live in rural areas.
They have lost a lot of rights, and right now they are only trying to survive. That's why they right now are also in a very, very bad mood. They have lost hope. They have a sense of no future.
The poverty level among indigenous populations is 70%. Many of the indigenous people live in the rural jungle or mountain communities, like one within the district of Machu Picchu. Residents here don't have running water or electricity, nor do they have a bridge to cross a river that runs through the center of their town. Instead, they use a large basket attached to a rope pulley system to pull themselves across. Even though his cousin fell out of the basket and died last year, 18-year-old Hector Esquivel still crosses the river this way every day.
It's not safe, but it is the way we have to go to school. It saves a lot of time than if we had to walk.
21-year-old Ronald Delgado also lives in the Indian community. He says the majority of the children in his town do not have a bright future simply because they do not have proper educations.
El problema es que tenemos pocos alumnos, pocos alumnos.
The problem is that we have very few students. The children here can't go to college because they don't have money. Some study in their high schools and work right after that, usually in coffee and cocoa fields.
Trabajar lo que es café, coca.
Delgado goes to a university in nearby Cusco on Saturdays and Sundays. But when he is not in school, he picks fruit and earns less than $2 a day.
I work from 8 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon. I only work to help my parents.
Today, people of indigenous background are 45% of Peru's population. Mestizos, or people mixed with indigenous and European races, represent 37% of Peru's people. Anthropologist Raul Castro says Peruvian identity is a mix of both Spanish and Incan culture, developed when Spain conquered Peru during the 16th century. He says the colonial attitude is still in place.
Cuando los españoles llegan,
when the Spanish arrived, they brought over a little. Their manner of understanding imperial reality that they had in that moment also what was in Spain.
Lawyer and human rights activist Wilfredo Ardito says racism is so embedded into Peruvian society that no one asks questions about it. Ardito says discrimination angers him since most Peruvians accept racism as a normal way of life.
Sometimes I prefer not to think that this has happened, but then or sometimes I will have to speak up and to show that they shouldn't treat me in a certain way, no? But sometimes it can be difficult because they have this chip in their mind. A black person, an Indian person, a mestizo person cannot be treated in the same way as a white person.
When he's not practicing law, Ardito devotes his time to a second job, one that does not pay. He volunteers with an anti-racism group supported by the Human Rights National Network in Peru. Ardito says his organization helped crack down on racism and even helped to find a club in a suburb of Lima.
There was a disco called Aura, and we managed this disco. We received a fine of about $30,000 because of the practice of racial discrimination. There was also there was a program in television that was extremely racist, and we have managed also that this problem would be canceled. This problem came back, and finally it has now being canceled again.
Ardito has joined forces with Peruvian journalist Nelson Castillo, who says it's important for the Human Rights National Network to raise awareness about racism.
We are here working, try to educate the people, to try to identify what are the reasons of the racism and how to combat it. It's not only matter to know, but it's only matter to act.
For the past 4 months, volunteers have been working on an anti-racism handbook for high school students. Sociologist Pilar Arroyo says those in the white upper class, which is only 2% of Peruvian society, see themselves as citizens of the world, not citizens of Peru.
They only think of our country as the place where they make a lot of money and they take the money out, but they don't think they have social responsibility. For them, the market is the best allocator of all the resources, and if you are poor, it's your problem, and if I am rich, it's my merit. And there is no ethical questioning of that situation.
At the Jockey Plaza shopping center in a suburb of Lima, 24-year-old Linda Perez works as a salesperson at an expensive Italian clothing store. The mall is crowded with security guards and welcomes Peru's upper class. Perez says there is no discrimination at the mall, and people who can afford the goods can buy them.
A lot of times there are people that have this appearance that they are living a certain way. There's a lot of people that seem very poor, but they actually have more money than people in the upper class.
Ardito says that's not an uncommon statement. He says that in Peru, money isn't the only thing that determines social class.
Como en toda América Latina, esta pirámide social...
Like in all Latin America, this social pyramid permits you to descend only if you marry whites that are at the top. If you marry from below, you descend the social ladder.
Dr. Monica Stadolska, who studies ethnic minorities in the U.S., says the life of indigenous people of Peru is very much like the life of Native Americans in the United States.
Physical attacks, being called names, being denied jobs, are being treated in a patronizing manner. My honest belief is that Native Americans in this country experience the most racism of all ethnic and racial minorities. No doubt about it.
University of Illinois student Geronimo Caldwell is part Cherokee. Although Caldwell feels Native populations should have opportunities to maintain their cultures, he feels there will always be some tension between Indians and mainstream society.
Our society is shattered and will never be able to return to what it was, or even close to what it was. Some societies even more so than others.
Many indigenous people in Peru share the same sentiment in their own country. With separate cultures that are slow to homogenize, Peruvian society is struggling to unite. Although progress is in its early stages, Ardito thinks his organization will help change racism in Peru and all over Latin America.
Everybody knew that the door existed there, but nobody wanted to open, because it was a sort of taboo. They didn't want to speak about this problem. Since we started speaking about this, there have been many journalists, many leaders of the public opinion who have started to speak about this, to write about this. Little by little, society can change.
I'm Cynthia Edwards.
The racial and socioeconomic inequalities in Peru trickle down to many sectors of society. While Peruvians see education as one key to future success, in a country where for some day-to-day survival is the top priority, education can be an afterthought. Clarissa Magus explains.
Like many children in the United States, children all across the country of Peru have big dreams.
Computación.
Yo quisiera ser un abogado.
Futbolista.
Doctora. Medicina.
Yo me voy a ir a Italia a estudiar a una universidad.
Abogada.
Veterinaria.
Químico.
Some want to be doctors and lawyers. Others, chemists, soccer players, veterinarians, and nurses. But unlike many children in the United States, Many of these children may never realize these dreams. Villa El Salvador is a poverty-stricken community outside of Lima. The buildings that line the dirt streets are run down. Many people here believe the government has forgotten them. In the heart of town is the Francisco Bolognesi School. Children ages 6 to 18 go to school wearing tattered uniforms. They play soccer on a dirty concrete playground. The desks are worn and unsteady. The bathrooms leak out onto the playground and reek of human waste. And some teachers say there aren't enough books or other resources for the children. One mother is frustrated with the condition the school is in.
We need a better playground. The teachers also need more resources so that they can teach a little more to the children. And the books the government donates, they don't actually donate. They loan them because we have to return them later.
A group of sixth graders at the school also complains about the problem.
At other schools, they give computers, and here we don't have computers to use.
They don't give us anything at this school.
Education in Peru wasn't made mandatory until the 1950s, and it wasn't until 1993 that the Peruvian Constitution extended compulsory and free education from primary to secondary school. But the government has never provided the money to operate the schools. And former curriculum unit director of the Ministry of Education, Carmen Monroy, says this poses a problem.
In rural schools, school ends after grade school. There is no high school for students that should continue their education.
And parent Candelaria Salina says she doesn't believe the current administration of President Alejandro Toledo is working hard enough to improve the schools.
Nothing. He doesn't give anything to the schools. He does nothing but stroll around. He said he was going to give 100 soles a month, but the schools are abandoned.
Even in the areas of the country that generate millions of dollars in tourism, the story is the same. Inverto Una School is in the mountain city of Cusco, the gateway to ancient Machu Picchu. Here, parents pay the equivalent of $10 a year to send their children to school. The director of the school, Matilde Unda, says the money from tourism goes to Lima, so the school in Cusco is in really poor form.
The students come to learn in poor conditions because the infrastructure, the educational institutions, are not well maintained. We don't have the economy to make improvements.
Former Minister of Education, Dr. Jorge Treyes, says this is because education is not considered fundamental.
No hay una planificación, digamos, razonada, y la educación que debería ser un asunto técnico.
There is no planning. Education should be something concrete, but for us, it's something more political. So we're not advancing seriously in the topic of education.
Former education ministry official Carmen Monroy agrees that throughout every administration, education has never been considered a priority.
If a child needs to leave school because a parent can't pay for the child's school, for example, the first thing a parent thinks is, well, don't go to school this year then.
Teacher Elizabeth Espinosa says lack of government money isn't the only problem at her school. Many children living in poverty are forced to work after school to help support their families.
Children come to school already tired. Sometimes they don't assimilate. They don't come to school a lot. They don't come to take their test. There is plenty of absenteeism because they dedicate their time to their jobs. They give more preference to that, and they consider education as something secondary.
Unda says that means children often come to school hungry.
These children sometimes come to school malnourished. We don't have a plan to provide them food. The malnourished children don't assimilate. They can't learn.
Private schools in Peru, especially those concentrated in Lima, don't face the same problems that public schools do. In general, the children who attend those schools come from the middle to upper class. Therefore, their parents can afford to finance a proper education for their child without worrying about how much the government will provide. And some middle-class parents decided to take the education of their children into their own hands. About 30 years ago, they founded Colegio Carlos Lizón Bengolea, a mathematics and science academy. The cooperative school began in a teacher's house in the rural parts of Lima and has grown into a well-known, prestigious private school. Parents are involved in administration and financial affairs. Director Mercedes Vasquez Garcia believes that contributed to the success of the school.
Here the parents have identified themselves with the institution and with these students, and the students have become successful.
So successful was the school that founder Jorge Garcia Mia says the students routinely have the highest test scores in the country.
When there's hope and a desire to do something, one can achieve results.
The cost to attend the school is $150 a month, making it one of the cheapest private schools in all of Peru. But the average Peruvian earns less than $120 a month, making this private school out of reach for most parents. Yet some progress has been made in the public school system. For example, the average level of education has increased from 1.9 years to 8.6 years of school. And the literacy rate for females is now 86.8% and 95.2% for males. But there are still thousands of children who don't have textbooks or have never seen computers. Many children still come to school hungry and tired from working or begging for money at night. Education problems still plague the impoverished country of Peru.
That was Clarissa Mancus reporting. Peru's educational system is an example of the inequalities that some fear could spark a revolution. Peru has already lived through terrorism when in the 1980s, Maoist and Marxist followers waged a terrorist campaign against a newly formed civilian government. Ryan Hubbard reports on how Peru is still dealing with its terrorist past.
Terrorism haunted Peru for nearly 20 years. During the 1980s and most of the 90s, parents were afraid to let their children walk to school. People had no certainty they would make it through a day without experiencing a car bomb, assassination attempt, or some other form of bloody insurgency. The terror was the work of two organizations, Sendero Luminoso, or Shining Path, and the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement, or MRTA. The two groups rebelled against the government and fought against each other. The MRTA believed in Marxist-Leninist theory. The Shining Path were adherents of Maoist theory and by far the more violent group. The government fought back and it became an armed internal conflict. 30,000 people were killed during the terror. Peru's death toll from terrorism is 10 times the number of deaths that resulted from the September 11th attacks on the United States. Dr. Guillermo Cavala was the magistrate of Peru's Supreme Court during the country's crackdown on terrorism in the 1990s. Cavala became Peru's national prosecutor of terrorism 5 months ago.
Terrorism started out in smaller cities. It gradually started coming to bigger cities such as Lima, and then it created an environment of terror, fear, and suspicion. Women and children were being killed and exterminated everywhere, left and right, and it grew and grew. And people kept migrating to bigger cities like Lima, so they played a role as well.
Terrorist attacks began 10 years before the presidency of Alberto Fujimori. As soon as he was elected into office in 1990, Fujimori used extreme measures to combat terrorism. But critics say the methods that Fujimori used to fight terrorism violated human rights and due process. They say those who were arrested for alleged terrorist activities were often tortured, interrogated, forced to confess, and then tried in closed military courts led by judges who often hid their faces with hoods. Fujimori then dispatched government troops to lead the fight against terrorism. In 1992, he issued anti-terrorism legislation that has since been declared unconstitutional. Cavala says today Peru continues to work on fixing the judicial errors made during Fujimori's term.
What Fujimori did was a big mistake on his part, and right now we need constitutional order, so this is necessary.
Aníbal Sánchez was convicted of terrorism in 1993. He won't talk about the specifics of the charges the government filed against him, but he says his trial is an example of how the system mistreated terror suspects.
According to Peruvian law, one needs to be notified within an adequate time period to prepare for their defense. In my particular case, I was in my cell when they came and told me I would be taken out for my trial and said, "You have 5 minutes." No, really it was 2 minutes to get dressed and go up to the trial. I was not notified in any formal manner, and I did not know if I would have a lawyer or who my lawyer would be to defend me.
Sanchez also says he could not see his accusers and that evidence against the accused was often fabricated by police. Sanchez was convicted of treason against the fatherland for being a member of the MRTA.
The trials were all similar. There was no respect for procedural norms. Judges were behind one-way glass. So you didn't have any way of knowing who was being behind the glass, and you were judged without having any contact with the judges. Like many people, we were sentenced to court proceedings which occurred over 1 or 2 days. That means in 1 day they would conduct the same trial, and then at the end of that same day would give the sentence. In my case, I was given a 15-year sentence.
It was in prison where he met and later married one of the most well-known inmates convicted of terrorist charges, American Lori Berenson, who is still serving her 20-year sentence.
I met Lori in 1997. We were together in the Yanamayo prison. After that, she was transferred and our communication was through letters.
Berenson was convicted of involvement in the MRTA in a military court in 1995. Due to international pressure, she was retried in a civilian court in 2001, and her sentence was reduced from life to 20 years in prison. Berenson is currently detained in a prison in Cajamarca, Peru. During a meeting with Berenson last month in Cajamarca, that prison regulators would not allow to be tape recorded, she was reluctant to speak about her own trials, but pointed out the changes made in 2003 to Peru's anti-terrorism legislation still do not respect prisoners' rights enough. Prisoners and activists claim Peru continues to apply a vague definition of terrorism and continues to violate due process. In February 2005, a group that pushes for the rights of political prisoners, the Popular Movement for Constitutional Control, received enough signatures to file a petition that addressed their complaints with Peru's High Court. And prisoners say other human rights are being violated. The women convicted for involvement in the MRTA terrorist group detained in Santa Monica de Chorrillos prison, one of the prisons where inmates complain about the substandard conditions, say they do not have sufficient access to education, work, or health care. Marie Manrique is the founder of a nonprofit organization that gives social aid to political prisoners in Peru. She says even though prisoners lose their right to freedom, they should not lose their basic human rights.
The people that work in prisons have to buy their own work materials, and not all of the prisons have the same work opportunities.
One American woman knows all about prison conditions in Peru. Danville, Illinois native Jennifer Davis spent 3 years in a Peruvian prison with her best friend after they were convicted in 1996 for being drug mules. She says not having work materials was the least of her worries.
Yeah, I mean, there was mice, there was, you know, rats, there was cockroaches. I mean, you sleep and you wake up and there's cockroaches running down your legs, under your pants.
The women I spoke with in the prison where Davis was detained said the conditions have improved slightly since Davis was there, but not much. Ralph Rubner is a law professor at John Marshall Law School in Chicago. He and his colleague represented Davis during her time in a Peruvian jail.
The court system, the legal system, provided absolutely nothing for an American prisoner. The idea of being charged, speedy trial, effective representation, the ability to confront and cross-examine witnesses, that's foreign stuff for them. Peru is a member of the international community. They are bound by the various treaties and conventions that they joined to provide all of that, but it was not a priority in practice for them to do that, especially for foreigners.
Former Minister of Justice Dr. Diego Garcia Sayen says the problems within Peru's prison system may stem from a bigger issue within the country.
According to UN rules on prisons, people may have must have a place to work, must have an appropriate health system. I won't say that all that works in Peruvian prisons, but maybe in a sense it doesn't work in the country at all. Peruvian citizens do not have an appropriate health system, so that's the country in which we are living.
But Garcia Sayen defends Peru for having made some changes in both prison conditions and the way terror suspects are tried.
Some improvements, not enough, but some improvements have taken place.
Today, Garcia Sayen is a member of the Inter-American Court for Human Rights, and he says the new trials for those convicted of terrorism are restoring more justice in Peru's legal system.
I would say that the Peruvian prison system is not a model at all. Nobody would or could say that. But there has been consistent efforts so that their minimum rights are respected.
Peru's national prosecutor of terrorism, Guillermo Cavala, agrees that defendants' rights to a fair trial are now being protected.
A uno, a todos los abogados que ellos quieran.
They have the freedom to get whatever attorney they want. The judges that are handling these cases are not nameless, faceless judges. These are very well-known judges. So they have all the freedom in the world to get the best kind of defense possible.
Much debate remains on how much Peru has improved its justice and prison system over the past 5 years. But most people in Peru can agree that they see similarities between their experience in the 90s and how the United States deals with terror suspects today. And human rights activist Marie Manrique points out that the United States can learn a lesson from Peru.
You better do it right the first time, or else you're going to have to be redoing it again in the future. And the United States needs to recognize that they have the chance to respect basic human rights now, respect due process, respect judicial guarantees, so they should start doing it now, and particularly because the United States government knows what those international norms are.
But Guillermo Cavala says the United States is handling terrorism suspects appropriately.
With the Fujimori era, there was a lot of corruption, and it is very different than what is going on in the United States. I think that with terrorists, you need to be very cautious, and you need to handle it in a very specific way. So you need to come in and really be strong. So I don't think that there may necessarily need to be new trials in the future. I don't see the same situation in the United States that there was in Peru.
Former Minister of Justice Dr. Garcia Sayen says respecting due process and human rights is also a lesson for the whole world.
Peru has shown or is showing that to prosecute terrorism, you can do it inside the framework of the rule of law, respecting due process, and that among all the major difficulties that exist in many countries and that have existed in Peru, I think that that is a process that must be studied very closely.
The United States government has been widely criticized, most recently by Amnesty International, for its treatment of terrorism suspects in prisons like Guantanamo Bay. It will take Peru at least 3 years to retry more than 1,000 inmates who were convicted of terrorism under a process now seen as unconstitutional. Reporting, I'm Ryan Hubbard.
Terrorism has subsided in Peru since the 1990s, although there are still pockets of rebels. And as you heard during this hour, concern that problems plaguing Peru could make it ripe for future unrest. Stay tuned for another hour of this special report produced by University of Illinois journalism students. Next hour, we'll focus on the future of Peru. We'll get out the crystal ball to make predictions about what might happen in the 2006 presidential election. We'd like to thank everyone who made this trip possible, including the Center for International Business Education and Research, which provided funding for the trip, and journalism students and faculty at Peru's University of Applied Sciences in Lima. I'm Abby Rhodes, inviting you to join Matt Stensland for part 2 of Assignment Peru.